weather trends, expert takes, and the truth behind the data, you're listening to Weather Waves, found at WXWaves.com.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're plunging into a really powerful and honestly quite terrifying force of nature, tsunamis. We've got some fascinating sources here that really get into what's going on with these ocean giants, from how they start kind of mysteriously to the incredible ways we're trying to predict them and, you know, lessen the damage. Our mission today is to go beyond that classic image of just one giant wave.
Yeah, and it's fascinating, isn't it, how much we think we know versus the much more complex reality. Tsunamis, okay, they're not frequent, but the threat is serious, and it's global. I mean, historically, we're talking hundreds of thousands of lives lost, hundreds of billions in damage.
Yeah.
So this deep dive, it's about understanding what they are, why they're so devastating, and also the critical lessons we've learned, lessons that are, well, literally saving lives now.
Okay, let's start right at the beginning then. What exactly is a tsunami?
Our sources define it as a series of waves, not just one big one, generated by a really large sudden displacement of ocean water. So think less like a single monster wave and more like a whole sequence of powerful surges, each one just capable of immense destruction.
Right. And let's clear up something you hear all the time. Our sources really hammer this home. They are not tidal waves. That term is, well, it's common, but scientists really discourage it. Tides have almost nothing to do with causing them.
Exactly. Now, sure, if a tsunami hits during high tide, the flooding can definitely be worse, more compounded. But the tide itself isn't the trigger. That's a key distinction.
So what are the triggers then?
Well, the vast majority, something like 80% of all the tsunamis we know about, they're kicked off by large earthquakes, usually under or very near the ocean floor. But it's not just earthquakes. Our sources point to other things too. Big landslides, volcanic eruptions, even certain kinds of weather, and yeah, even meteorites hitting the ocean.
Wow, okay. Meteorites too.
Yeah. And once they get going, these waves, they radiate outwards, you know, in all directions. They can cross entire oceans, bend around islands, and they move incredibly fast in deep water. We're talking jet plane speeds.
As fast as a jet plane, that's hard to picture.
It is. But then, as they get closer to shore, where the water gets shallower, all that energy sort of piles up. They slow down, but they build height, sometimes dramatically. And that causes the dangerous flooding and these powerful currents that can just keep going for hours, sometimes days.
You mentioned a few different triggers there. Earthquakes are the main one, okay. But what about the others, like landslides? How do those work?
Right. So with earthquake-generated ones, it's important to know that not every earthquake makes a tsunami. It needs to be big enough, yes, and close enough to the ocean floor. But the key thing is it has to cause a significant vertical movement. Basically, a huge chunk of the seabed suddenly gets pushed up or drops down like a giant piston displacing all the water above it.
A piston. Okay, I get that image.
And the size of the tsunami depends on, well, how much the floor moves, how big an area moves, and also how deep the water is right there at the source.
Okay, and you mentioned landslides too. Are those common?
They're another significant type, yeah. They happen in two main ways. Either a huge mass of land slides into the water from above, it's called subaerial, or it happens underwater, a submarine landslide, which also displaces a lot of water.
And what's different about those?
Well, what's really striking is that landslide tsunamis can actually be bigger than earthquake ones, but only near their source. And the really scary part, they can hit nearby coasts in just minutes, often with little or no warning.
Minutes? That's terrifyingly fast.
It is. But the trade-off, if you can call it that, is they usually lose energy much faster than seismic ones. They rarely affect coastlines far away. Now, most of these landslides are triggered by earthquakes shaking things loose. But sometimes it's just gravity or heavy rain or strong winds making a slope unstable.
So that complicates things for warnings, I guess, if an earthquake causes both types.
Exactly. You could have the direct tsunami from the seafloor moving and a separate one from a landslide triggered by the shaking. A double whammy.
Okay, earthquakes, landslides, and then you mentioned weather. Meteorite tsunamis. That sounds like something out of science fiction.
Doesn't it? But they're real. These are caused by large storms and pretty intense air pressure changes, often linked to fast-moving weather systems, like squall lines or severe thunderstorms.
How does a storm make a tsunami-like wave?
So the storm itself generates an initial wave out at sea. As that wave travels towards the coast, it gets amplified. Things like a shallow continental shelf or the shape of bays and inlets can really magnify it.
Huh. And how big can they get?
We've seen them reach heights of 6 feet, maybe even a bit more.
Yeah.
And they happen all over the Great Lakes, Gulf of Mexico, the Atlantic coast, even the Mediterranean and Adriatic seas.
So they're not just an ocean thing.
Right. And this brings up a really tricky point. Telling a medio tsunami, apart from, say, a small earthquake tsunami or even just storm surge or a seiche.
A seiche? What's that?
Oh, think of water sloshing back and forth in a bathtub. A seiche is like that, but on a much bigger scale, like at a large lake or a bay.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, telling these apart is a real challenge. Their characteristics can look almost identical. And that makes predicting and warning for medio tsunamis incredibly difficult. Though NOAA scientists are working hard on figuring out the exact atmospheric conditions that spawn them.
It's one thing to understand the physics, but grasping the sheer scale of these events throughout history, that's something else. Our sources provide a really sobering look back.
They really do. There's this incredible resource, the NOAA and World Data Service Tsunami Database. It catalogs events way back to 2000 BCE, right up to today. And the data comes from everywhere. Scientific papers, historical catalogs, tide gauges, deep ocean sensors, and critically, also from oral histories from indigenous communities. Those were actually key in figuring out the story of the orphan tsunami of 1700 in Japan, when it happened before modern records.
An orphan tsunami?
Yeah, meaning there was no locally felt earthquake recorded in Japan, but the tsunami damage was clear. The oral histories, combined with geology on the U.S. West Coast, pointed to a massive earthquake over there.
Wow. And what do the numbers tell us overall?
Well, the database has about 2,800 reported events. Over 1,400 are confirmed tsunamis. And more than 270 of those were deadly, resulting in over 544,000 known deaths.
Over 500,000.
And that number is likely much higher. Especially in older events, it was hard to separate deaths caused by the initial earthquake from those caused by the tsunami itself. Records weren't always clear.
Where do they happen most often? Is there a pattern?
Definitely. You look, just between 1900 and 2015, there were 754 confirmed tsunamis. A huge chunk, 78%, were in the Pacific Ocean, the Ring of Fire, right? Another 5% in the Indian Ocean.
And specific countries.
Japan stands out with 21% of those, and Indonesia with 8%. They're in very active zones. Here in the U.S., we see tsunamis maybe twice a decade on average. The biggest risks are along the Pacific coastlines, Alaska, Hawaii, and also in the Caribbean. And we shouldn't forget volcanoes like Krakatoa back in 1883. That eruption triggered a devastating tsunami, too.
Right. But the one event that seems to loom largest in recent memory is the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami. Our sources really use that as a benchmark.
Absolutely. It was, well, a truly catastrophic event, December 26, 2004. It started with the third largest earthquake recorded since 1900 off the coast of Sumatra, magnitude 9.1. And the rupture itself was enormous, about 800 miles long. Think roughly the length of California's coastline. All of that shifted.
800 miles.
Yeah, about 19 miles deep. It displaced a massive amount of water, setting off a tsunami that spread across the entire Indian Ocean and even beyond. Some places were hit within 20 minutes, others hours later. It was detected by over 100 tide gauges worldwide.
And the impact. It's just staggering to read about. It hit 17 countries, over 250,000 deaths, 1.7 million people displaced from their homes.
And the economic toll by 2017 was estimated around $13 billion.
In Indonesia's Aceh province, which was closest and hardest hit, the waves reached, what was it, up to 167 feet?
That's right. Flooding went up to 3 miles inland in some areas.
Just imagine, homes gone, roads, power, clean water, all wiped out.
And the environmental damage, too. That saltwater intrusion ruined soil, killed crops, devastated ecosystems. It literally changed the landscape. It was a profound wake-up call.
Absolutely. And that really brings us to a crucial turning point, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The 2004 disaster wasn't just a tragedy. It sparked a massive global push to improve preparedness.
It really did. I mean, the stark realization was you can't effectively warn against something you can't properly see or measure in time.
Mm-hmm.
So there was this huge ramp up in detection technology. The number of those DART buoys, the deep ocean assessment and reporting of tsunami buoys, went from just 6 in the U.S. network to 39.
Wow, from 6 to 39, that's a big jump.
Huge. Suddenly we had eyes, or ears rather, across the Pacific, the Atlantic, Gulf of Mexico, the Caribbean, a true global network instead of just regional pockets. It meant we could actually detect a tsunami forming thousands of miles away in deep water before it neared land.
So better detection out at sea, what else changed?
Well, alongside the DART buoys, 188 coastal water level stations were installed or upgraded. The Global Seismographic Network, which detects the initial earthquakes, was improved to send data in real time, 100% of it.
And the warnings themselves, the forecasts.
That improved dramatically too. NOAA developed much more sophisticated forecast models. They could predict arrival times, how long the event might last, potential wave heights, and even map the likely extent of coastal flooding. The Tsunami Warning Centers got expanded responsibilities. And importantly, the Tsunami Ready program was started.
What's that focus on?
That helps communities on the ground. Risk assessment, evacuation planning, public education, making sure warning communication systems work locally. It brings it down to the community level.
And there was government action too, right?
Yes. Congress passed the Tsunami Warning and Education Act in 2007, later updated as TWERA. It basically formalized NOAA's leading role and provided the structure and funding for this national effort, including the National Tsunami Hazard Mitigation Program, or NTHMP.
Okay, so we have these Tsunami Warning Centers. You mentioned NOAA runs them. Where are they?
There are two main ones in the U.S. The National Tsunami Warning Center, NTWC, is up in Palmer, Alaska. It covers the continental U.S., Alaska, and Canada. Then there's the Pacific Tsunami Warning Center, PTWC, based in Hawaii on Ford Island. That covers Hawaii, the U.S. territories in the Pacific and Caribbean. And it also serves as the main operational hub for the International Pacific Tsunami Warning System.
And they're watching constantly.
24/7. They monitor seismic data constantly. When a big enough quake happens, they look at data from the coastal water stations and those dart buoys out in the ocean. That buoy data, relayed by satellite, is crucial. It confirms if a tsunami was actually generated and measures its height in deep water, which helps them refine the forecasts using their models.
Is anything else used, like satellites?
Yeah, that's an evolving area. Satellite radar altimeters, things like JSON-3 and Sentinel-6, they measure the sea surface height from space. Mm. They can actually detect the very slight bulge of a tsunami wave crossing the open ocean. This data is helping refine the models, making travel plan predictions even more accurate. It's not fully operational for a real-time warnings yet, but it's getting there.
And when they issue a warning, what form does that take?
Well, the NTWC and PTWC issue four different types of alerts, depending on the potential threat level, ranging from just an information statement to a full warning. These go out to emergency managers, local officials, the public, the media. And, you know, it's not just the official NOAA channels. There are private services, too, like iAlert.com, that played a role.
How so?
They take the official warnings and push them out directly to subscribers, email, text, automated calls. They even have APIs for organizations. Mm. So it creates this multi-path delivery system, which is really important, right? It increases the chances that the warning actually reaches people quickly and reliably through whatever channel they use. It builds resilience.
That makes sense. Multiple paths are better than one. So looking ahead, what's next? The warnings are better, but the goal is resilient communities, right?
Absolutely. The work definitely doesn't stop at warnings. Building resilience is key. NOAA's National Weather Service is working on aligning the two warning centers even more closely. The goal is consistent forecasting, alerts, and importantly, seamless backup if one center ever goes offline.
Okay, operational improvements.
Right, and that NTHMP program I mentioned, the National Tsunami Hazard Mitigation Program, that's a big ongoing effort. It's this unique partnership, NOAA, FEMA, the USGS, plus 28 coastal states and territories. They focus on everything from mapping the hazards and risks locally to education, planning for mitigation and recovery, and improving the alert and response systems on the ground.
And research, is that still pushing boundaries?
Well, yeah. NOAA's Pacific Marine Environmental Lab, PMAL, they're developing new ways to detect and model tsunamis for even more accurate real-time flood forecasts. They're also working on models specifically for those non-earthquake tsunamis, landslides, volcanoes, even asteroid impacts, assuming they can get good data on what triggered it.
Asteroid impacts? Wow.
It's a low-probability, high-consequence scenario, but they model it. And they're looking at combining weather data with ocean observations and AI to try and forecast wave heights for those tricky medio tsunamis and other non-seismic types.
And what about like buildings and infrastructure?
That's another big area. NOAA is working with the American Society of Civil Engineers to develop, believe it or not, the world's first probability-based tsunami design standards for buildings. Basically, building codes for structures in flood zones, figuring out how to deal with debris, which causes huge damage, and creating much more detailed local inundation maps, factoring in future sea level rise as well.
It's amazing how many pieces have to fit together. But beyond all the tech and the planning, you, the listener, play a role too, right? Knowing the natural signs.
Absolutely critical. Sometimes nature gives you a warning before the official systems can. You are often the very first line of defense. There are three key things our sources say to look out for near the coast. First, strong ground shaking, or shaking that lasts for a long time. If you feel a significant earthquake near the coast, first, drop, cover, and hold on. Then, as soon as the shaking stops, move to high ground or inland immediately.
Don't wait. Okay, what else?
Second, an unusual disappearance of water. If you see the ocean suddenly recede, pulling way back past the normal low tide line, exposing the seafloor, that's a huge warning sign. The water will come rushing back.
Like the ocean taking a deep breath before roaring back.
Exactly. And third, a loud roar coming from the ocean. Some people describe it sounding like a train or a jet aircraft. If you hear that, evacuate.
So strong or long shaking, the ocean pulling back dramatically, or a loud roar if you see or hear any of those?
Don't wait for an official alert. Get to high ground or move inland as fast and as far as possible. Every single second counts.
And people can find out about their local risks.
Yes. That Tsunami Ready program helps communities get prepared. And you can usually find local tsunami hazard and evacuation maps on your state or territory's emergency management website, often linked through the NTHMP website, too. Knowing your local risk, knowing the evacuation routes, that's fundamental. Prepared communities save lives.
This has been quite the deep dive. It really shows the complexity and the raw power of tsunamis, but also the incredible progress in understanding them, monitoring them, and preparing for them.
The continuous effort, learning from the past, improving the technology, and crucially, strengthening that link between the science and the community action.
From diverse triggers to global monitoring and local readiness, it's quite a journey.
It really is. And maybe this raises a final thought. As our technology gets ever more sophisticated and our scientific understanding deepens, perhaps the biggest ongoing challenge is translating those incredibly fast warnings waves moving at jet plane speed into effective human speed evacuations everywhere around the world every single time. How do we consistently bridge that gap?
A really important question to ponder. Thank you for joining us on the Deep Dive. Stay curious, keep exploring, and we'll catch you next time.